You're listening to the Christian Humanist Radio Network, christianhumanist.org.
Ask six Americans what the adjective or the noun evangelical means, and you'll get as many answers. Ask six historians, and you might get 12. But what if you ask a rhetorician? We're going to find out today as Christian Humanist Profiles welcomes Dr. Bethany Manning to the show to talk about her book, I Grew Up in the Church, How American Evangelical Women Tell Their Stories. Along the way, we'll visit and revisit some figures and some phrases that our longtime listeners will remember from episodes of the Christian Feminist Podcast, and perhaps we can add to the conversations that we inherit from them. Shall we start? Dr. Manning, thank you for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. I'm happy to be here.
Personal narratives and persecution narratives and other kinds of stories are going to occupy our attention for the run of this conversation. So at the outset, I want to ask this. Do evangelical and feminist rhetoric return to stories in peculiar ways? Or do you think that narrative is just something inherently pervasive and that other studies of feminism and evangelicalism don't attend to as your scholarship does?
I think it is inherently pervasive. It's really popular with writers, with readers. That's been true for centuries. It became particularly true around like the memoir boom of the turn of the millennium. But I think when people have studied evangelical rhetoric, they focused on sermons and public oratory really often. And so that's what, you know, that's what I'm paying attention to that I think is new and a little underappreciated in evangelical culture.
That makes good sense. And I mean, you know, one of the things that is prevalent in, you know, popular treatments of evangelicals is that it's the person on stage that tends to get the focus. And one of the interesting things about this book is that certainly some of these folks are very public figures, but, you know, they tend not to be, you know, the megachurch pastors.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, they do have huge followings, right? But it's a different kind of audience. It's a different kind of interaction. It's, you know, some of them, like Rachel Held Evans, was a incredibly popular, incredibly effective speaker, and told a lot of personal narratives at women's conferences where she is the person up on the stage. But I think there's something a little different about a book that you read at home and keep on your shelf and return to over and over and spend time in the text, or in some of these cases, personal narratives on social media that you kind of encounter throughout your day. It's just sort of woven into the fabric of your life and maybe your spiritual practice.
Very good. Very good. Now, evangelical, like I said in the introduction, is a term that is contested really as long as the adjective has been around. So let's talk about your approach to this term. Rather than looking mainly at theological commitments or ecclesiology or political alignments, as some recent treatments of the term have done, you focus on rhetorical commonplaces as the phenomena that make evangelicals intelligible as a movement. So I used to be a rhetoric professor, so you've got me nodding along already. Talk a little bit about your book's methodology, and again, how it's going to differ from, you know, other sociological treatments, theological treatments. What does a rhetorical treatment pay attention to that those other treatments don't?
Thank you for asking. I mean, and I really want to hear what you think and what you, you know, taught and paid attention to when you were studying rhetoric. I think that evangelical writing and speaking is kind of like contemporary Christian music. Like when it comes on the radio, you don't even really need to be hearing the words to know, like, yeah, this is Christian music. And evangelical rhetoric has, I realize that it has this tone or this flavor or this kind of, there are these commonalities across topics, across time, I think, in some cases. And so I tried to wrap my head around that by naming the commonplaces, which are these kind of formulas for argument. One of the phrases that comes from Sharon Crowley, who's a really well-known scholar of evangelicalism and looks at apocalyptic rhetoric, or really well-known scholar of evangelical apocalyptic rhetoric. She calls them signal chains of argument. So even if you're not a rhetoric scholar, even if you're not even necessarily like an evangelical who's paid a lot of attention to theology and history, these are ways of making arguments and expressing ideas that you've kind of inherited and maybe learned in implicit ways by listening to sermons, by maybe you did a book group on apologetics, you know, the case for Christ, something like that. You've learned that these are ways of making an effective, godly argument. And so those are, if I can just read them out, there's eight that I found. There's probably others. But what I looked at was individualism, conversion, fear, divine providence, biblical authority, white supremacy, certainty, and combat. And some of these people are really aware of, maybe they've become really aware of them, like someone like Kristen Cobas Dumé writing about the combative streak in evangelicalism. But maybe not. Maybe they're a little bit more under the surface. And then there's five rhetorical practices I look at as being really characteristic. Those are evangelism, preaching, biblical hermeneutics, apologetics, and testimony.
That makes good sense. And the funny thing is that, I mean, as early as the 1980s, and I don't remember the precise year that this album dropped, but the Jesus rocker Steve Taylor, this is before the CCM industry became just house bands for megachurches. You know, I mean, he had a, you know, again, he was a satirical songwriter. And I mean, he was making fun of Christianese, you know, 40 years ago. So, I mean, it's fascinating that, you know, in popular treatments of evangelicalism, you know, the politics are often front and center. The theology is often front and center, but the rhetoric, you know, which everyone has been aware of for so long, really hasn't been the center of a study yet. So I think that's really a fascinating, well, I mean, a gap in the scholarship that you're starting to, you know, fill in for us. So that's really great. I never knew before I read your book that generous orthodoxy was a Hans Frey phrase. I love Hans Frey. I read Eclipse of Biblical Narrative, but I first encountered that phrase in the title of Brian McLaren's book by the same title. Mm-hmm. You use that phrase to describe, and if I'm reading you right, to praise some evangelical women's writing, even when the particulars of their politics and their cultural commitments are not the same as your own. So what are some signs of generosity that you point out for our readers when they go read your book and for our listeners as they listen to our interview?
So I'll preface this by saying that that was the hardest chapter for me to write. And I kept putting it off and thinking, I know I want to write about conservative women like Karen Swallow Pryor, Trillia Newbell, who are, if I'm reading them right, defending like complementarianism and biblical literalism and sometimes being pretty scornful of feminism and like liberal social movements. And I would read them and that would kind of get on my nerves a little bit. And I would think, let me come back to this. So that was a really hard chapter to write, but I didn't want to overlook that and just focus on the, you know, the evangelical women that resonate with my, you know, liberal feminist sensibilities. And I guess I came to really appreciate that what more conservative evangelical women are doing is differentiating between conservative politics and orthodox faith and really clearly and insistently, but kindly pointing out to their readers how these things have been intermingled and how many opportunities for making people's lives better are lost when orthodox faith comes to equate conservative politics. And so one of the hallmarks of the generous orthodoxy that I see is a kind of refusal to use the combative the the commonplaces of combativeness to kind of defeat your opponent in rhetorical combat. Instead, it's very like they're not wishy-washy. They're still very very certain what they believe, and they're appealing to the Bible as a an authority, but they're not using that as a weapon. And I think that makes them distinct from some other evangelicals. It makes them, to me, I think they belong in this conversation about evangelical women who are trying to change the way debates unfold in this movement.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things that I appreciate about this, and our listeners who have listened to a lot of these shows know that I'm a complexity junkie. So any author who complicates conventional binaries is going to find an ally in me. But one of the things I like best about this is that you bust up the binary between what you call resistance and subordination. So I mean, talk for a moment about the questions that emerge when there are possibilities beyond just subordination and, I mean, as you just now called it, liberal feminist resistance. What possibilities other than those two emerge when we pay attention to writers like Karen Swallow Pryor?
Well, she's a complicated example because in the time period I'm looking at, 2008 to 2018, I think she is really let's see. There's complexity and nuance here too, but she's teaching at Liberty. She's really well known in the pro-life movement. And since then, like a lot of things in her life and career have changed, and she's kind of speaking in a different way into a different audience and with a different relationship to that evangelical mainstream. But overall, I think if we're dividing women into like complicit with patriarchy and resistant to patriarchy, then we're going to miss people like, I think Wendy Alsup is really interesting and really kind of not given the attention that some of these other writers are. But she has an essay on her blog that I love and I think about all the time, where she says the model for biblical manhood that we actually get from the Bible is a farmer, not a warrior. And so I think if we're looking for, not just what bucket can we put these women in, even though I realize, like, to some extent, I do that when I decide what chapter, when I set up the chapters for my book. When we are looking for what are they saying that's new, that's kind of speaking into the same, speaking into a conservative conversation, but saying like, look, here's what you're missing. Here are some other metaphors we can use that open up new conversations and maybe spaces for healing, for outreach, for community. Did that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does. I think it does. And first of all, I'll go ahead and remind our listeners that both Dumais, who we've mentioned before, and Pryor have been on this show before. So be sure to go back and listen to those episodes. I'll try to put links to those in the show notes. But yeah, I mean, one of the things that or one of the conversations, I'll put it that way, that I've had with a lot of folks from more progressive Protestant contexts, right? Because I was a professor at a very conservative evangelical college for 14 years, is, they would ask, all right, when your commitments and their commitments don't match, I mean, how do you deal with that? And, one of the metaphors that I like to use is the bridge builder, right? I mean, I'm taking these kids from these evangelical backgrounds and building a bridge so that they can appreciate the work of people like Dumais and people who are, even more progressive. And often, I would bring them, into conversation with, Irigaray and, other feminist theorists that, before would have been simply enemies, but, now, I try to bring to them the possibility that, they might raise questions that are worth answering, even if your answers differ. And, that kind of work that, I mean, you see in that you see, your work sees in these, evangelical women who remain committed in evangelicals, it kind of resonates with that because, like I said, it reminds me some of my own experience with those things. So I really kind of appreciated that. Now, your second chapter, Spend some time examining Mark Driscoll's career. And one of your main sources here is Mike Cosper's podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. When I listened to that podcast, I thought I heard a kind of etiology going on that kind of ran through the whole podcast for the Trump phenomenon. So, I mean, I guess the enthymeme that I heard resonating there was, I mean, if we can explain why it is that evangelicals really got behind this figure who is very abusive, very macho, very offensive in a lot of ways, perhaps that we can, give an account for the more nationwide support for an abusive figure like Donald Trump. Am I stretching here to see Cosper's Driscoll as a commentary on the Trump phenomenon?
No, I don't think that's a stretch at all. And I think that you with the Driscoll phenomenon, you see the accommodations that people are willing to make when a person is achieving a certain kind of success in their mind. And I think often that's very worldly success. It's not the way that I think, and many of the women I study think a Christ follower should define success. But people are willing to, when they see church growth, when they see certain kinds of laws being passed, certain kinds of symbolic gestures, they are willing to overlook quite a bit from a leader if they are getting what they want in another space. I don't think that's a very original observation, and I'll just leave it at that. I'm not a political scientist. I don't think I have very much that's new to offer there. But from a perspective as a rhetorician, what I do see is that part of Trump's appeal is not, or part of Mark Driscoll's appeal is like you can disagree with a lot of what he's saying, you can disagree with a lot of his like lifestyle and stated beliefs, but his rhetoric is so familiar from these evangelical rhetorical commonplaces that he sounds like an evangelical, right? Like the combativeness, the certainty, the authoritarianism. Some people would say the white supremacy, the these signal chains of argument that he's using really resonate with what people have come to think of as evangelical discourse. So even if he doesn't believe like them, he sounds like them, and there's a really powerful connection there.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Real quick, before we get too much further into the book, you've used the term signal chain a couple times. That's a technical term. Can you tell our listeners for a moment what that term signal chain means? Because I think it's doing good work here. I want to make sure our listeners benefit from it.
Oh, thanks. I'm tempted to go get that book and look up where Sharon Crowley uses it because I quote it from her. What I mean by that, and this might take me a minute, is people probably don't have on their mind a clear like formula for here's how I would appeal to authoritarian, or here's how I would appeal to biblical authority to make a certain kind of argument. But that process has become kind of naturalized, kind of absorbed. Like when I want to define this, I appeal to the Bible. Or when I want to undermine someone else's claim, I appeal to like the importance of certainty. Or when I try and describe the role that a Christian should have in a secular culture, I talk about putting on the full armor of God, right? Like this combative, this argument about combat. And so they're a signal chain of argument, I think, means like there's these series of connections between the Bible or a theological concept and a way of making an argument in your speech and writing that you may not be conscious of, but have been passed down to you and kind of communicated over and over through your community.
That makes good sense. Thank you for clarifying that.
And
Now, one of the
you were a rhetoric
stories.
professor, so sorry, you were a rhetoric professor, so if you want to add to that or correct me, please do.
No. That's a good account of it. That's a good account of it. I want to turn, though, to one of the stories that you relate in this Mark Driscoll chapter, and that is that when you had a conversation with your own sister who travels in high-level Southern Baptist circles, and I won't go into any more detail, you can if you want to. She doesn't spend much time thinking about the terms complementarian or egalitarian. So I know that you're a rhetorician, not a statistician, but what, if anything, does that episode lead you to ponder? Not necessarily what answers does it give you, but what questions does it raise when it comes to the range and the gravitational pull of rhetoric like Mark Driscoll's?
Yes. Oh, yeah. And I will just say a little bit about her. Like, she's not in leadership. She, when you say she travels in high level circles, like, she used to go to a church that was led by a pastor who was basically a household name among evangelicals. And she and her husband were really, really involved, really plugged in. And at one point were even like leading premarital counseling. I asked her, do you have like an egalitarian or complementarian kind of approach to that? Because as I'm studying this history and reading these different writers and kind of their like getting into these debates, these were words that I knew. And she was like, I w like what does that mean? And that was just a really, I don't know, it's one of those moments where you think like, oh, there's something here about the way people talk and the way these ideas circulate. And like, that's wild to me that someone who is doing premarital counseling in an evangelical church, like these aren't the terms that are meaningful to her. And so I think there's a couple things going on there. Like, it's a good example of how there are these two distinct camps for how evangelicals think about gender and gender roles in marriage and in the world, but you might not know that you belong to one camp or the other, even if you have kind of been, your community and the books you read and your Bible studies and your sermons have probably guided you into one or another. And it also made me think, like, what is the actual utility of these terms? And I think there is something really useful. And this gets back to what you said about studying rhetoric in the church. To be able to put a name to what you think, what you study, how you've been habituated to talking and making arguments, can help you recognize, this comes from somewhere. This comes from human interaction. This isn't, an obvious lesson of the Bible, right? This isn't like in the plain text of the Bible. It's been formulated by humans. Who are imperfect and have their own political commitments. And shoot, there was one more. Hopefully you'll edit this out. There's one more thing I was going to say. It'll come back to me, but I'll just leave it there.
No, that's really great. And you asked me before about my own approaches to teaching rhetoric, and I mean Kenneth Burke is one of my big influences. And what you're talking about here reminds me of something he says early in The Grammar of Motives, and that is that his project is to examine these points of contention, not for the sake of dispelling contention, but for the sake of naming them and being precise about them, so that we can actually make decisions about those contested places in an intelligent way. And I'm paraphrasing him. He's a far better writer than I am a speaker. So, I'll go ahead and say that readers, you need to go look at that book. But, I think that, this kind of rhetorical study, you're right, even in contexts where people don't necessarily use complementarian and egalitarian as sort of shibboleths, right? As is so often the case in certain online circles, nonetheless, characteristics of complementarian and egalitarian are present there, so that if you do have these terms for them, like you said, and I'll go to another, Kenneth Burke essay, The Deterministic Screens, I mean, it gives us the capacity to pose certain questions that we wouldn't have the capacity to pose if we didn't have those terms. Does that make some sense of how I'm receiving your project?
Yeah, it does. And I think so one thing that I appreciate about women's memoirs is that they'll tell stories from their life about how they negotiated r the relationships in their own marriage. And that might resonate even if the terms egalitarian and complementarian don't. And then someone like Rachel Held Evans will say, like, there's this whole history and debate behind this, and here's where it comes from, and here's who the different voices have been, here's why it mattered to me, here's why it matters to other women in the church, here's why it matters for this bigger debate about biblical womanhood. Kind of unpacking that, showing like kind of like you said, you might the here are the questions that are worth asking, even if we arrive at different answers.
And the Christian Feminist podcast, which I'd mentioned before, and which our listeners will know, had their finale episode back in February, episode 200. So they reached a good round number and decided to hang it up, at least for the present moment. And all of us fans of the show say, no, you got to come back. But one of the things that I really appreciate about them is that their rotating cast of hosts included some people who did self-identify as complementarian, a lot who self-identified as egalitarian, and a lot of folks who are progressive enough that neither of those terms really does the work that they're wanting to do. So, that was a show, I think the most important show on the Christian Humanist Radio Network, that raised a lot of these questions without necessarily trying to settle the answers. And, that's the kind of intellectual engagement I really dig. But you mentioned Rachel Held Evans a couple times. Your third chapter is entirely devoted to the work and the narrative rhetoric of Rachel Held Evans. I've got a question or two that I'm going to pose about Evans, but I want to give you a chance first to show our listeners the importance of Evans in your project. Why is it, among all of the evangelical women rhetors that you examine, why is it that Rachel Held Evans gets the solo chapter?
She is such a prolific writer of personal narrative, so well known, and such a advocate for other women that, yes, I mean, I absolutely thought she deserved an entire chapter. I actually discovered she deserves an entire book. My second book is going to be about Rachel Held Evans. And I think that if I have, if there's one writer other than Beth Moore, if there is one writer that I talk about from my book, when I talk about my book to people who are not in evangelical or Christian circles, if there's one writer they've heard of, it's Rachel Held Evans. And so I thought, given her stature and given how thoroughly she like plumbs the possibilities of personal narrative, yeah, I wanted to spend a whole chapter with her.
That's really good. That's really good. Now, the question that, or the part of your chapter that, I found most interesting is when you present Evans not only as a practitioner of rhetoric, but as a teacher of rhetoric for evangelical women. So, what are some moments and what are some trends in her work that make her not just someone who delivers logi to her listeners, but also who teaches evangelical women new ways to be rhetorical?
She models a lot of that. Yeah, that's exactly. She, like you say, she delivers that, and I think that's what makes her really engaging and thought-provoking. But she models it pretty self-reflectively. So she will like in a in there's a in her first memoir, there's so many, and I'm think and I keep thinking of A Year of Biblical Womanhood, but I actually don't want to talk about that because it's really well known, and I want to talk about some of her less known writing. And in her first memoir, Evolving in Monkey Town, she tells a story about being graduating from college, being in her first job, and talking about current events with some with a colleague. And so there's something about evangelicals that comes up, and she says, I'm really sorry. I'm sorry that this is the public face of evangelicalism. And her colleague says, that's okay, it's because it's run by men, or something like that. And she realizes how clearly evangelicalism comes across as a movement that cares about, what is it, winning arguments, elections, and converts. And so she tells a story that kind of she's playing out or illustrating the way that evangelical rhetoric alienates people. It's almost like an example I would give in class, right? Like this is there's two different perspectives here. There's to me this seems normal. To me this way of talking seems like really characteristic, really unexpected. And suddenly I'm thrown into this situation where I see how it comes across to someone else. And that's just a really clear synopsis of a lot of what she was trying to do. In when she is delving into the Bible, searching for answers to her questions about gender, about motherhood, about marriage, about preaching and the role of women in the church, or about like are what happens to the innocent women and children in the Middle East who are Muslim because of where they were born, rather than, in the same way that she was Christian because of where she was born. So as she delves into the Bible looking for those answers, she plays out for readers, here's the question I was asking, here's what I was looking at, here's what I was told to think, and here's where I'm finding a little bit of discomfort or a little bit of nuance and complication, or a lot of nuance and complication between what I'm thinking, what I've been taught, what the Bible's saying. Oh, that was a pretty long answer to a pretty short question. I feel like I just kind of talked in circles around it. Do you want me to clarify anything
No,
or
that's
come
fine. I
back to
mean,
anything
I
you
actually want
said?
to follow up on that a little bit. Yeah, I want to follow up on that a little
Okay.
bit because, one of the things that, you talk about in the Evans chapter and in other parts of the book is a certain resistance among evangelical authorities, for lack of a better term. Not necessarily to the, well, let me back that up. There's a resistance to the content of what she says, to be sure. There's also a resistance to the narrative mode that she uses. So, I mean, what are some of the arguments against narrative as a form, in addition to narrative as the content that you document in this book?
Yeah, and well, narrative is inherently subjective, right? It foregrounds the individual person and their experience and perspective. And I don't think it typically holds that up as authoritative. It holds it up as insightful, right? A path to kind of knowledge and self-knowledge and reflection and connection with other people. But critics will attack it and did attack her as downplaying the authority of scripture and holding herself up as an authority. In place of scripture, or not taking the Bible seriously, right? By exploring it and playing with it and being funny. And I think pretty often, when Evans responds to those critics or on her blog, she'll demonstrate that like she absolutely can engage with the Bible in the same way that evangelicals typically have by saying, here's my position and here's all the verses that support that. And or here's the study that I went through to arrive at this interpretation and this understanding. But she opts to use personal narrative, which steps outside that formula a little bit because it is so engaging and because it reorients people towards the human and like lived dimension of the debates and the kind of evangelical rhetoric that she's examining.
That's good. That's good. And, like I said, the most interesting, part of this particular study of Evans, is, like I said, that suspicion of narrative, when it is complicating things, when in other parts of your book, and I mean, I think that you point this out very well, when evangelical leaders use, narrative in order to bolster or to buttress, the conventional evangelical position, there's a lot of praise for it, right? So I mean, if there is a story about, we conducted our marriage in a complementarian way and, we ended up coming through a great struggle, there's no problem with that, subjective this or that, but the complaint that it's subjective comes in when complexity rather than, oh, what would the opposite of complexity be here? I mean, when reinforcement is not on the table.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't write a lot about Beth Moore, but like she has been such a public example of that. She was to beloved and accepted and could do whatever she wanted within evangelicalism. When she was telling her stories to, and maybe she would say, maybe that's not true, but that's how it seems from the outside, right? That was kind of the public role she occupied. When she was telling her stories and sharing her experiences to reinforce what was accepted and conservative and kind of the typical conversations among women. But when she says, here have been my experiences of being sexually assaulted and harassed by other men in evangelicalism who I thought were my Christian brothers, then all of a sudden, yeah, that is a totally different story to when you're using your personal narratives that way. And this makes me think back to your question about how Evans was a teacher of rhetoric. I mean, she's asking her readers and showing them how to think about not just how do you use evangelical rhetoric and how do you use these commonplaces and these practices, but how are you the audience for them, right? How has this been used by your preachers and your camp counselors and maybe your parents and your professors, and so for example, were you taught to use apologetics? And did that then maybe equip you to start unpacking some of the beliefs and claims you were hearing? And then she's been so associated with deconstruction, which I really think is a misreading because she cares so much about, well, then what do you build after you deconstruct? And so she is offering, I think, a wealth of rhetorical resources for how you can rebuild a faith that you want to inhabit and that can sustain you after you've deconstructed.
Yeah, I've deconstruction is always a sore point with me because I was in grad school 25 years ago. So when people started, talking about deconstruction this and deconstruction that, I thought, oh, we're finally going to talk about Derrida, and then we never talk about Derrida. So that's always
That's
just a
funny.
disappointment to me. But
Yeah, that's funny.
I want to go to your fourth chapter, which really is interesting to me because we're moving to authors who are still definitely using evangelical commonplaces, but present what I see as a more direct challenge to evangelical orthodoxy than some of the authors we talked about in chapter two, to be certain, but even to a greater extent than Rachel Held Evans does. So talk about particular moments as you see fit, but as a general matter, who are these authors that you focus on, and how do they use, I mean, what I see as, very conventionally evangelical rhetoric to challenge some of the content of evangelical commitment?
Yeah, it's totally traditional to tell your story and share your narrative of faith and share your narrative of how God has worked in your life, even to share your narrative of studying the Bible and arriving at a more faithful, more informed, kind of more biblically rich, stance on something. And so these writers are taking that very accepted avenue for women to speak publicly, and they're using it for ways that are, I think, a little subversive, a little resistant, with a caveat, maybe not anymore, right? From 2008 to 2018, I think this was subversive, and I think it may, it may feel more familiar now. Anyway, and so that includes things like critiques of purity culture. So Sarah Bessie tells a story of being told she is. What is her phrase is damaged goods, right? The title of that essay is In Which I Am Damaged Goods, of the way that sexual activity outside of or before marriage is presented as damaging a person and making you kind of lesser. Jen Hatmaker is another author write about. She talks about that as well. She writes really pointedly about what's postmodernism and the kind of this kind of generational difference between evangelicals who think like if you can't state a position with absolute certainty, if you can't or you can't kind of talk yourself into a place where you feel absolute certainty about an issue in your faith, then that's trouble. That's dangerous. And she kind of spells out and tells these stories that illustrate why that's just not how kind of the evangelicals she was working with, I think probably like her kids' age, you know, the younger generation that she knew, that didn't matter to them, right? Certainty is like they don't need older, they don't need their teachers to say, I have all the answers and so can you. They want someone who will be in conversation, be in this place of searching with them. And then I write about Austin Channing Brown, who I may have made a mistake there in calling her an evangelical or including her in this chapter. I definitely, you know, I encountered her book because a lot of evangelicals were reading it and were recommending it and kind of in conversation with her and what she was saying about the white evangelical church. And she has a background of working in white in evangelical parachurches. I believe she worked at an evangelical college. I would have to double check that. And so she's
That
very
sounds right.
familiar
That
with that
sounds right.
space. Okay, yeah. I wrote something on social media where I called her an evangelical writer, and she responded and said, "I would never call myself evangelical." And I won't anymore, right, from this point on. And so I just want to include that as a caveat. Like that may be the wrong way to label her, but in any case, this is someone who's speaking to white evangelical issues and readers and confronting them with this is like look at how white evangelical churches use personal narrative. They use it to delay actual conversations about racial injustice and violence. They use it to kind of assuage their own consciences, right, by unpacking and kind of offering up their experiences in kind of place of genuine repentance. And I think that is, and she, the other thing that she's doing is telling her story of being in black churches and how different teaching and conversations look there.
That's good. That's good. Now, I want to go on to your fifth chapter because it explores the work of specifically Latina evangelicals and the context in which they find themselves influential, even when formal authority still isn't within their grasp. And I thought that dynamic was fascinating. So start where you will, but on the way to where you're going, say something along the way about the ways in which these authors come to use Altre Vida as a theological term. That strikes me as one of the most interesting rhetorical features and something that I really hadn't encountered when I have read about, these figures.
Oh, sure. Okay. So I'll make sure that that's on my route as I talk about this chapter. Yes, I love that. I like this book, Hermanas. I think it's interesting. It's doing something interesting with narrative. There's three authors writing together, and they write their own sections, and then they put them in conversation with each other. And each chapter deals with a different woman in the Bible, interweaving interpretation of that story. So someone like Rahab, someone like Esther, pretty well-known figures, and lesser-known figures like Tabitha, lesser known to me anyway, and interpreting those stories, often seeing a challenge to hierarchy, often seeing a like an advocacy for social justice in those stories, and interweaving them with their own experiences of working in, I think all three of them work in parachurch organizations. None of them are ordained pastors, or they weren't at the time and in the experiences they're talking about. And one of the stories that they tell is being told, no seas atrevida, like don't be bold, don't be a bold woman, as this kind of lesson, message, way of being in the world that they learned from their home contexts. And through reading the Bible and seeing how Jesus interacted with women, coming to reclaim that idea of atrevida and being being bold for Christ, right? For in your ministry, in pursuing a relationship with God. And so it's, yeah, this like feminist tradition of taking a word and reclaiming it as a powerful call to a rich life and faith as a woman. It's I didn't make this connection in the book. It's like Rachel Held Evans saying woman of valor, right? Finding there's these really lovely resonances across like the different women in the book that I don't know if they knew each other or were in conversation, but are I think there's some unity of purpose there.
And I confess I have forgotten. Women of valor, that's a phrase from Proverbs 31, yes? Or is that from
yeah.
a different passage in the Bible? Okay, yeah, go ahead.
That's right.
Very good, very good. Now, one of the points of focus in your chapter on Latina evangelicals, and this is another one that, you know, I had encountered this phrase in a very different context, and that's the phrase analogical imagination. So I associate that term with the theologian David Tracy and his book about Christian theology's place in religiously plural contexts. But when you use that phrase, you tend to turn towards allegorical readings of biblical narratives. You already mentioned Tabitha, you already mentioned Rahab, you already mentioned, I think, Ruth and Esther. My questions, I've got two of them is, one of them is, you know, in your reading, I mean, you know, is that phrase analogical imagination something you've encountered a lot in the scholarship, or is that something that you brought to this study, first of all? And second of all, what kinds of things do we pay attention to when we pay attention to analogy?
Yeah, I have not. I have only found that in Alan Jacobs's book, Looking Before and After. He's an English, pretty sure English professor at Baylor. Yeah. And
he is.
Yeah. And that book is about telling better stories about our faith, that the kind of I once was lost, but now I'm found formula is really constricting. Also, not everyone can tell that kind of story. And so he's advocating for telling different, more open-ended, sometimes maybe more mundane stories of like a long-term sustained rich faith rather than like the dramatic moment of conversion. Anyway, yeah. And I thought that was really interesting. And one of the things that am I remembering this right? He says one tool for telling stories about our lives is analogical imagination. So seeing where our lives might find analogies in the stories of the Bible, and how that can make us reflect on ourselves, how it can kind of help us to understand. I don't think he says this, but how it can help us, the writers in Hermanas look at how that can help them understand their historical, political, and social context. So, for example, they look at the story of Ruth, and they say, this is a woman who was a migrant. She's finding a home in a land that is not where she was born. Where she is treated as an outsider and an other and is sort of economically disadvantaged. And so that's an element of the story that they see because of their experience and subject position. But then finding that analogy helps them think back onto their own lives. And so what does the Bible tell us about how to navigate that kind of circumstance? It's a very, the other thing that they talk about a lot is a really embodied faith. I don't know if you want me to get into that, but that's a part
do.
Of,
please do. Yeah. Cause that's another interesting element of their work.
Yeah. So it's kind of calling attention back to the physical experience of suffering and hardship. So they write about the woman with chronic bleeding who touches the hem of Jesus's robe and he calls her He calls her my daughter, and in their reading, they use mija, the Spanish word for my daughter, and that's how they refer to her, which is lovely. And it's a little bit of a rereading. It's not changing the meaning of the text, but it is changing a bit the way that might land with the reader, right?
Yeah,
Um,
and
and they're pointing
like
out
I
how
said,
much,
oh no, go ahead. Sorry, I misread your nonverbals. Keep going.
And in that story, they're pointing out how much he cares about her body, right? Her physical, and not just her soul, not just her, eternal salvation, but the her physical hardship and the way that that has put her into a marginalized place in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, again, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that your book calls my attention to, and you've mentioned this a couple times already, is just how much, or I guess how little we pay attention to what I'm going to call broad political changes and the ways that they change evangelical rhetoric. Because I mean, one of the things that I've made note of before on this podcast and in other places is how when George W. Bush was a prominent political figure, you know, the sort of subversive evangelicals of that era were very concerned with making sure that, you know, evangelicals didn't dedicate themselves to a political party. And then, you know, in the Obama era, those same figures, you know, became very dedicated to advancing what I call Obama evangelicalism. For very different reasons. And then when Trump becomes, you know, the center of the political universe for these weird 10 years that we've just had, you know, the questions become very different still. And I mean, evangelical in ways that would have been very surprising in the 16 years prior becomes a mild curse word among certain circles, right? So I mean, I think it's fascinating that, you know, these sorts of trends that you're tracing in the years that include the first couple years of the Trump era, but you know, really predate those. Those are in place before Trump brings them to the fore in ways that they weren't foregrounded before. Does that make some sense?
Oh, it very much does. And they were the women that I'm studying are also drawing on decades previous, right? These are conversations that have been going on even before they took them up and learned from them and kind of brought them to a new readership. They also, I think, recall the tradition of the Christian progressive era of the late 19th century, and the social gospel. And this is a period I want to know more about, but I see connections there. And so I think that's powerful for women to rediscover these earlier periods when evangelicals have worked for justice and equality and human dignity, and that is part of the inheritance too, as well, even though it may not be the most prominent strain in evangelicalism during the time that they're living and working.
That makes real good sense. As we wrap up today, I wanted to take another rhetoric question, not a rhetorical question, but a rhetoric question. And I want to start with a little narrative of my own. When I was in high school in the early 90s in central Indiana, I learned to my horror that Jim, who sat behind me in algebra class, was a Ku Klux Klan member. And I don't mean that he had some racist tendencies. I mean, he showed up at rallies with a hood on. And this was, like I said, the early 90s. It was central Indiana. So I learned to differentiate between people whose policy ideas differed from my own, on one hand, and people who had radically different convictions from me, on the other hand. And I also learned to distinguish between folks with radically different convictions from mine, on one hand, and white supremacists, on the other. Jim was a white supremacist. I mean, he showed up for the Klan rallies wearing the hood, right? Now, to go back to Kenneth Burke, because of those experiences, I tend to treat white supremacy as an ultimate term, to use Kenneth Burke's term, right? If you can demonstrate that someone is a white supremacist, that's the end of the conversation, okay? A lot of the figures that you treat in this book use white supremacy in a far more broad-based sense as I read them, right? So I mean, talk about this a little bit, and I'm going to leave this wide open for you to go any direction you want to go. is white supremacy more powerful as a term when it has a broader application, or does it have a certain power that it loses when it is an ultimate term that only applies to people like Jim from algebra class? Or am I asking entirely the wrong questions?
No, you're asking a good but difficult question. So is white supremacy as a term and a concept more powerful as an ultimate? Wait, is it more powerful when it's broad-based, and does it lose its power when it's used as an ultimate term?
Well, no. So, I mean, I think I guess my binary, and this might be where you have to bust up my binary, is that it can either be an ultimate term. In other words, if you are this kind of person, nothing else that you do or say really matters in the rest of the conversation. Or it can be something that is so pervasive that entire cultures can be white supremacist. And when you say that, you are not condemning them the way that I would be condemning Jim from algebra class.
Oh man. So recently I've been reading about rhetorical empathy, which is an idea that you may. And the scholar who works on this is Lisa Blankenship, and her idea is that you may at times decide to find where you have common ground or where you can understand where Jim from algebra class is coming from and how he became a Ku Klux Klan member. And that may be an ethical choice that you sometimes want to make, and that may be a rhetorical choice you sometimes want to make, so that you can then have a conversation with him. And not always, right? She's not saying like this is something you need to do, and she fully acknowledges like the personal harm and personal risk that can include. And the example she gives is of being a queer woman with conservative. She might even be from Indiana. I don't. She's from the Midwest, and she talks about going home and like trying to have a conversation and connect with people that she says I know what they think about. People who are not straight. And so she kind of comes to this idea from her own experience and her own willingness to do this, and seeing the fruit that it can bear. And so I think that when you treat white supremacy as an ultimate term, you're shutting off that opportunity. Maybe sometimes that is a line that you need to draw. Maybe sometimes that's the ethical decision. But I think that also, if I'm understanding your question right, thinking of white supremacy in that as that ultimate term as the Ku Klux Klan member means that you're maybe not seeing the person who would say, "I'm not white supremacist, but I do think America was founded as a white Christian nation." And what I think that probably meant most of the listeners in this podcast would say that that's clearly a white supremacist stance. But maybe the people that we are in conversation with out in the world don't see it that way. And so I think that's one of the rhetorical projects for. Shoot, I'm like way out on a limb here, but I think
No,
that that's.
you're making very good points. And if I
Okay,
could follow up just a
good.
quick moment, I
Yeah.
mean, I would put folks who say that America was founded as a white nation basically in the same category as Jim from algebra class. The place where I wouldn't put them in the same category, but where a lot of public discourse, especially online discourse, does, is people who say, I agree with, recent Supreme Court decisions on college admissions. Right. When that Supreme Court case was handed down, at least in the online circles that I travel, and it might just be that I travel weird online circles, the phrase white supremacy immediately became part of the conversation. And like I said, my own gut reaction to that is when you use white supremacy about policy differences, you are taking some of the power away because people will say, well, I mean, if everybody is that, then what's so bad about people who say America was founded as a white nation? Now, I might be overreacting to that because of my own experiences with gym and algebra class. I'll grant that possibility, right? But like I said, I mean, that's a personal reaction of mine that I'm still trying to figure out. So I figured, a fellow rhetorician I've got on the call, I'll ask you about it.
Oh, well, yikes. I'm sorry. I'm sorry if my answer disappoints you. I think
No. Like I said, I think you're raising a very good point.
I'm glad you think that. I'll just add that there are writers that I could have included in this project and started to write about, and then I thought these are not ideas I want to amplify and put out into the world. And I'm not sure what I would say about them other than like, this is damaging, this is destructive, this is not like a path for evangelicals or Christians to go down rhetorically if they want to be engaging the people around them in questions about faith and identity and human dignity.
That makes good sense. Well, Bethany, I've been at the wheel for most of this conversation. So, in the spirit of hospitality, I'm going to let you have the last word. What do you want our listeners thinking about testimony, rhetoric, evangelicals, or whatever else as we head for the door?
So there's two things. I want men to read stories by women. I think that if you want to be in community with the women in your congregation, in your town, in your department, seek out the stories that they have told about themselves and read them in a spirit of curiosity and humility to understand rather than to argue or analyze. Just go in to listen. And the other thing I would say is that I really hope that evangelicals who or people who are studying evangelical culture and rhetoric will pay attention to these strains of women's writing and voices. So they're not in positions of power. They're often not leading organizations that we hear about all the time, but they are having an influence on the ground. And so I'd love to see more attention, more curiosity, more work done with the kinds of arguments that they're making.
Anthony Mannon, thank you for joining us on Christian Humanist Profiles.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure and a really good conversation.
Listeners, thank you for downloading and listening in. The book is I Grew Up in the Church from Baylor University Press. Christian Humanist Profiles is part of the Christian Humanist Radio Network. Our audio editor is Britt Stack, and I'm Nathan Gilmore saying, go in grace, go in peace, serve the Lord.